From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I was, that is my countrymen, in a hopeless minority. Not only hopeless minority, but a despised minority. If the Europeans of South Africa will forgive me for saying so. We were all coolies. I was an insignificant coolie lawyer. At that time, we had no coolie doctors. We had no coolie lawyers. I was the first in the field.
Mahatma Gandhi. 50 years ago today, he was assassinated. Today, we will bring you a documentary on the modern-day leader of India. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Amid some skepticism, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is in Madrid, Spain, for talks on the Iraqi standoff. She's to meet with Russian Foreign Minister Yevgeny Primakov. He'll be giving her an update on a Russian diplomatic mission to resolve the weapons inspection impasse. Saddam Hussein has prevented UN inspectors from examining a number of weapon sites. Albright and other U.S. officials are preparing the way for a possible military strike, saying diplomatic options are all but exhausted. Authorities investigating yesterday's deadly bombing of an Alabama abortion clinic may now have more to go on. The Birmingham News reports a witness saw a man wearing a wig fleeing the scene just after the explosion. Police aren't confirming the report, but say they're questioning a number of witnesses. The blast at the Birmingham clinic killed an off-duty police officer working as a security guard and critically injured a counselor. It's the first fatal bombing at an abortion clinic in U.S. history and came just a week after the 25th anniversary of the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion. One of the central figures in the scandal is speaking out for the first time. Former White House staffer Linda Tripp, in a statement issued through her lawyer in Washington early Friday, says she overheard parts of a 2 a.m. phone call between Monica Lewinsky and President Clinton. Tripp says it happened last November while she was visiting the ex-White House intern's apartment. Tripp's lawyer says he's not going to characterize the call, but says it lasted about 20 minutes. And he says all the information is headed to the grand jury investigating the president. A federal judge in Little Rock, Arkansas, ruled that lawyers representing Paula Corbin Jones in her sexual misconduct lawsuit against President Clinton could not use any evidence involving the former White House intern Monica Lewinsky, a setback in helping them to make their case. The judge said that while information about Lewinsky might be relevant to Jones' case, her participation in Jones' sexual misconduct trial could interfere with the criminal investigation being conducted by the independent counsel Kenneth Starr. Negotiations between Lewinsky's lawyer and Starr have stalled, lawyers say, partly because she's not offering prosecutors as much detail about her conversations with President Clinton as she reportedly disclosed to a friend on secretly recorded tapes. Authorities investigating yesterday's deadly bombing say they now have more to go on. The Birmingham News is reporting that they saw a witness in that abortion clinic bombing. Officials in the Peru, their UN officials inspecting Peruvian jails, would not say yesterday whether they had met with an American woman serving a life sentence for treason. Lori Berenson, who's 28 years old and a New York native, is being held in Peru's notorious Yanamayo prison, 525 miles southeast of Lima. Lori, a former student at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, was found guilty of treason by a hooded military judge based on evidence she could not see on January 11, 1996. Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori has insisted that Berenson is a terrorist who is helping Tupac Amaru rebels plan an armed takeover of Peru's Congress and that she would receive no special treatment. But her family says she is innocent and is carrying out a campaign to either free her or have her receive an open civilian trial. This news from San Cristóbal de las Casas in Chiapas, Mexico. Two gunmen shot and killed a peasant leader outside his home in the capital of the rest of southern state. Rubicel Ruiz Gamboa died late Wednesday from two bullet wounds to the back, according to Chiapan Radio. Ruiz Gamboan Peasants Independent Central Organization has been active in the coastal Sierra Madre Mountains, where peasants have invaded coffee plantations and taken over town halls to demand land and later democracy. Gustavo Zarate, a leader of the State Democratic Assembly of the Chiapas people, of which Ruiz Gamboa's organization is a part, said the killing in Tuxtla Gutierrez, that's the capital of San Cristobal, was an attempt to sabotage efforts to renew peace talks between the state Zapatista rebels and the federal government. Russian President Boris Yeltsin reportedly is saying it again, a third term is out of the question. He says he won't violate his country's constitution by running for a third time. Some top aides have suggested otherwise. And the Justice Department reportedly has launched a criminal antitrust probe of three big tobacco companies. The Wall Street Journal reports Brown & Williamson, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, and Philip Morris may have rigged the price of tobacco in violation of antitrust law. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today marks the 50th anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi's death. He was gunned down on January 30th, 1948, by Nathuram Godse, a Hindu nationalist enraged by Gandhi's overtures to Muslims after the partition of Britain's Indian Empire into predominantly Hindu India and officially Islamic Pakistan. Gandhi was always against the partition of his country. The date of his death is now an Indian holiday, Martyrs' Day. And today we bring you an unusual documentary, which was produced by Radio Netherlands by Pete Myers. It's a documentary based on archival sound gathered over the last 50 years from intimates of Mahatma Gandhi and talks about Mahatma Gandhi's life. We bring it to you today.
A few days before his assassination, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, age 79, speaking in New Delhi, had a premonition that his life's journey could end with violence. In a whisper, he said, "If I am to die by the bullet of a madman, I must do so smiling. There must be no anger within me. God must be in my heart and on my lips." On January 30th, 1948, at 5:05 in the afternoon, the madman arrived. As Gandhi's soul took flight, he uttered two words, "He Rama, O God."
In the 50 years, I think our stress should be to present Gandhi, to bring out Gandhi from the books and from the museums and present it to the younger people, those who have not seen, not heard about Gandhi. But they know something about Gandhi, you see. Even a child of the age of 3 or 4, if you show him any picture of Gandhi, he will certainly recognize this is Gandhi. But he would not know which Gandhi he is, whether he is Rajiv Gandhi or Indira Gandhi or Mahatma Gandhi or what is he. Then the child knows that this is the picture of Gandhi, I mean, who had done something to this nation. But point is this, that message is to be transferred to him, but not academically, but by practicing him, by practicing his ideas. I think that would be the biggest task during these 50 years of Gandhi's martyrdom.
Bapu Lal Sharma, a program coordinator with the Gandhi Peace Foundation in Delhi today. Bringing Mahatma Gandhi out of the museums and history books is no easy task for modern-day Indians. In the 50 years since his death, industrial India has changed beyond recognition. And though Gandhi's statue, bust, or picture can be seen in thousands of towns and cities, he's also something of a forgotten prophet, a dead saint to be worshipped rather than followed. 15 years ago, there was an upsurge of universal interest in the Mahatma when the film Gandhi was released. But after its makers picked up innumerable awards, interest waned, and the little man in his homespun dhoti returned to the mists of history and mythology. His epic life has been abundantly documented. At the last count, there have been something like 550 biographies of the man. His own writings can fill a library. Now, it's not my intention to present a biography of his life, as I have always been guided by the words of Pandit Nehru, who said, "No man can truly write a real life of Gandhi unless he's as big as Gandhi." What I have before me are images of the man as recollected by people who had intimate knowledge of him and shared in his quest for truth and freedom. They left their memories in a sound archive that's been sitting in our vault for decades. Hearing these voices from the past, and an occasional one from the present, only confirms what an admirer said on his death 50 years ago, that Gandhi made humility and simple truth more powerful than empires.
His voice never rose above a certain timbre. He never raised his voice, but it was a penetrating voice.
I was wondering what I was to speak to you. I wanted to collect my thoughts, but let me confess to you that I had no time, and yet I had promised yesterday that I will try to say a few words to you. Whilst I was coming with Badshah Khan, I asked for a little piece of paper and pencil. I got a pen instead of a pencil. I tried to scribble a few words. You will be sorry to hear from me that piece of paper is not by my side.
The fact that stood out about Gandhiji was how he attracted people of different kinds, completely different kinds, and thereby he became, you might say, a link between different groups, different individuals, from the poorest peasant, whom he always sought to represent, to princes and rich industrialists and others. They were all attracted in their own way, and no doubt influenced by him to some extent. Well, I don't know how to define the bigness of an individual. He was certainly the biggest individual that I have come across in my life.
Jawaharlal Nehru, 20 years younger than Gandhi, who throughout his life was fascinated, mystified, and often troubled by his mentor. But his faith in Gandhi's moral leadership never wavered. The Mahatma was a self-made man, born in 1869, showed no particular ability as a youth, and according to Hindu custom, married at the age of 13 to Kastubai Nakanji, also 13. The marriage, often turbulent, lasted 62 years. In 1891, he became a lawyer, studying in London, and 2 years later went to South Africa in the hope of making a career.
I was, that is my countrymen, in a hopeless minority. Not only hopeless minority, but a despised minority. If the Europeans of South Africa will forgive me for saying so. We were all coolies. I was an insignificant coolie lawyer. At that time, we had no coolie doctors. We had no coolie lawyers. I was the first in the field. Nevertheless, a coolie.
Coolie, the derogatory word Europeans in South Africa used to describe indentured workers from India. Gandhi intended to stay a month in South Africa. He stayed 20 years, fought the long battle for Indian rights, and won. But more importantly, it was here that he formulated Satyagraha, a Sanskrit word, Sat, meaning truth, Graha, firmness. His philosophy of truth, love, and non-violence that worked in Africa and would eventually topple the British Empire in India.
I knew that he was a Hindu by religion and philosophy. And I was surprised, therefore, when I went into his personal office to see immediately above his working desk a very beautiful picture of Jesus Christ. It gave me an idea then of the breadth of his outlook on religious matters. Later on, I learned more of that when I found that some of his most intimate friends were Muslims and Parsis, as well as Christians, and some Jews as well. So I then appreciated the unity of thought based upon all the religions.
Henry Pollack, a European Jew and one of Gandhi's many international followers, and who went to jail with him in South Africa. The Mahatma was a brilliant self-publicist, and by the time he returned to India in 1914, his fame as an unusual leader gained momentum. But first he had to discover his own country, Babulal Shama.
Before propagating his ideas or political philosophy in the country, he spent the one full year, to travel around the country and to feel the nerves of the society. And I think he is the best person who had understood this Indian society in its form. And he was the great, mobilizer, social mobilizer. So Gandhi's contribution to the Indian society is that he made this society to feel that it is they themselves, it is the Indians they themselves who can decide their fate, not anybody else.
Seeing the abject poverty of India's villages led to the revival of the spinning wheel, which was his attack on rural poverty and became a symbol of freedom. The British rulers didn't know what to make of him, and neither did the Indians. The nationalists expected a giant to lead them. What they got was a saintly celibate whose humanity and message of nonviolence perplexed them. After the brutal massacre of hundreds of Sikhs in Amritsar by the British in 1919, he entered the political arena and would remake the entire nationalist movement in India.
When he came into the political field in a big way and made, rather astounding proposals, asking, for instance, lawyers to give up their practice and live simply and on next to nothing, everybody to wear hand-spun clothes made in the villages. The whole atmosphere changed, and many of our older leaders who wanted to cooperate with him, nevertheless, were not quite clear what all this meant, because they had been thinking differently. There was a conflict for some months.
It took Nehru and the Indian Congress Party ages to come round to Gandhi's way of thinking. But could non-violence be organized as a dynamic assault on the British Empire? Bilal Nair, a congressman, was convinced it could work.
No, there was no contradiction between non-violence and his political goal, because he wanted political independence for the least in the land. He said the least, the weakest in the country, even the halt and the lame, must be able to enjoy the full measure of independence and the fruits of independence with the tallest. So it had got to be a battle which the weakest and the least could wage with equal success. And that was the moral battle. And therefore, non-violence. Non-violence thus became the means as well as the end.
And so began the first mass movement of non-cooperation under Gandhi's leadership. It was also a brilliant way to unite Hindu and Muslim in a common effort that might dissolve their differences. He told people that if they simply withdrew their obedience to the British, accepted suffering, but avoided violence, freedom was inevitable. Tens of thousands went willingly to jail, including Gandhi, on numerous occasions. The first time in 1922 for publishing an article that was openly seditious. He was sentenced to 6 years, but only served two. When he arrived at the jail outside Pune, he was greeted by his English jailer, Patrick Quinn, who instantly admired his prisoner.
Chiefly the fact that he was simple and honest, you know. You knew that when you talked to him, there was no double shuffling going on. But again, you also realized he was one jump ahead of you. You know what I mean? He was always, what I would say, a model prisoner. Because he always believed in sticking to the rules. If there was something that he couldn't agree with and he couldn't get his way, hunger strike was threatened, you see, and nobody wanted that.
Those famous fasts, viewed as emotional blackmail today, always got him his way. The freedom he wanted for India had to be won without bloody revolution. It had to be based on the rescue of the villages from degradation, social regeneration, self-help, the full emancipation of women, and above all, the removal of untouchability within the Indian caste system. Untouchables became children of God. In 1930, he launched a new campaign with a band of Pick followers. He marched 241 miles from his ashram to the coastal town of Dandi to defy the ridiculous salt tax, which made it a crime for Indians to possess salt not obtained from the British government.
You're listening to a documentary produced by Radio Netherlands on this 50th anniversary of the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi. We'll be back with that in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with Piet Myers and Radio Netherlands, their documentary on this 50th anniversary of the assassination of one of the great leaders of modern India, Mahatma Gandhi.
In 1930, he launched a new campaign with a band of Pick followers. He marched 241 miles from his ashram to the coastal town of Dandi to defy the ridiculous salt tax, which made it a crime for Indians to possess salt not obtained from the British government. By the simple act of gathering salt deposited on the seashore, the march, followed by an army of correspondents, became an epic symbol of defiance. And the image of Gandhi, walking stick in hand, leading his people, has become the most enduring image of the man.
It was early in the morning, and Dandi is a very beautiful seashore. Always on the sand, there are some deposits of salt left when the water is receded. So he just picked it up, a pinch of salt, you know, and gave it to the next person who was standing by. I don't recollect his or her name. And that was a symbol of breaking the salt act. And, of course, all the correspondents that were trailing us, especially trailing Gandhi, kept us also informed about what was happening in the country.
As a result of touching salt, 60,000 Indians were thrown into prison, including Gandhi, a month after his gesture. Krishna Lal Sriharani was there when the police arrived.
In the midst of that excitement, there was one man who was completely unmoved and very quiet and very self-composed, and that was Gandhiji. He asked the police superintendent to have to give him time to brush his teeth, and he brushed his teeth with a twig like any other Indian in presence of the policemen and all of us. Then he asked the police superintendent to read out the warrant, and he was behaving as if nothing extraordinary was happening.
And calmly, he returned to prison and the care of Patrick Quinn.
I met him at the gate, and he was very pleased to see me and laughed quite heartily. He just said that he was delighted to renew our acquaintance and to start teaching me Gujarati again. But we used to spend, I should say, a very pleasant 1 hour or so every evening talking not only about Gujarati, but about everything else under the sun, you see.
Gandhi's humor was one of his great characteristics. As India seethed outside his prison walls, he spinned, chatted with his jailer, and wrote letters. In one to Madeline Slade, he says he's quite happy to be in jail as he's catching up on his sleep. Slade, the daughter of an English admiral, had joined Gandhi's ashram in 1925 and lived with his family till the end. He called her Meera Ben.
I had only one thought. That was to reach Bapu's feet. We went into that room on the riverbank, and there was Bapu. and he got up and walked towards me. I went down on my knees and he picked me up, took me in his arms and said, you shall be my daughter. And I never realized how near one could get to anybody. As I found myself with Babu. Absolutely simple, absolutely natural, and at such an elevation. And two or three times I heard Babu say to people when they were talking to him, I have only been able to just begin this experiment with nonviolence. I'm trying to put people on the road. But it will need many Gandhis to bring it to perfection.
The major body of the Congress, the main freedom movement, was having a meeting in the ashram in the center. And one of our students, girl students in the school, in the college, was ill. Gandhi left the meeting with all these big people, all the names you can think of, Nehru, Rajendra Prasad, Maulana Azad. He left the meeting to come and sit near this girl, putting cold water pack on her head and spending some time with her because she was really suffering. For him at that time, that human element was much more important than a meeting with all these big people.
Devi Prasad was a disciple who joined Gandhi's ashram in Savagram as a young man and assisted in his educational reconstruction program.
He was a very simple man. I think we should really here understand that simplicity was not just a ritual with him. Simplicity was a political element for him because he knew that the modern world was heading towards a life which is anything but simple, a life of comfort, a life of consumption, a life in which people needed more and more for their comfort, for their enjoyment. And he knew that that spirit was going to bring doom to the society. And so he had this intuitive feeling. It was not just a religious or a spiritual factor in his life or in his philosophy. It was a basic element that if you want to be imaginative, if you want to create things, then you must be resourceful. And it is only poverty and voluntary poverty, basically, which makes you more and more creative, more and more resourceful. His relationship with people was not intellectual. And really, to be very honest, he was not an intellectual in the ordinary sense. Certainly, he was not an academic.
The day the Second World War began, the British took India into the war by proclamation without consulting any Indians. In spite of Indian resentment, Gandhi, who always did the unexpected, pledged his support for the British. It was a magnanimous gesture, but futile. In 1942, with the war going badly in Europe, the Mahatma, together with scores of his followers, was imprisoned for the last time. Together with his wife, they were sent to the Aga Khan's palace, where he remained incarcerated for almost 2 years. In that period, his wife died. Agitation for his release swept India, and in 1944 he was released. Altogether, in his long struggle over the years, he had spent a total of 2,089 days a prisoner of the Raj. At the end of the war, it was clear that India's freedom was inevitable. Bankrupt Britain could no longer afford the jewel in its crown. But the price of freedom was partition. India would be divided into Muslim and Hindu nations, a vivisection regarded as blasphemy by Gandhi. At 75, he may be a revered figure, but the gulf between him and India's younger politicians was growing. He was old, tired, and regarded by some as a spent force, as Sushila Nair remembered.
Then, while he used to spin, I used to read out Bernard Shaw's plays to him. And I remember reading Joan of Arc to him and how he enjoyed it. Particularly when, at the end, Joan says, now I am a saint, and I can come back to life if you want me to. And first of all, the parson gets up and he says, for heaven's sake, don't. And the king also says, no, we don't want you. And one is sometimes reminded whether he may not get the same reply from certain quarters today.
As historic political moves proceeded in Delhi, Hindu-Muslim violence erupted in East Bengal and later Bihar. Gandhi headed for the troubled areas, trying to soothe the people's fears and stop the carnage. Suraya Ghosh made the long journey to visit him.
He seemed to be very far away from everybody and from everywhere. Even physically, he is so distant. The villagers pointed out to me the house where he was staying. It was a dhobi's house, the house of a village washerman. The villagers gave him shelter. He ate whatever food they gave him. In those 3 days I was with him, he walked with me with his hands on my shoulders. And one morning, throughout the entire walk, he talked in that whispering voice. He surveyed the whole Indian situation, the entire Indian political scene. He is a struggle for 30 to 40 years for Indian independence. At the end of it, he heaved a deep sigh and he said, don't you see the loneliness of it all?
In the summer of 47, the British sent a peacock as its last viceroy to India with powers to settle the independence issue and quit India with indecent haste. It was Lord Mountbatten's task to inform the Mahatma that Congress had accepted the inevitability of partition. It was a Monday at that meeting, and Monday was Gandhi's weekly day of silence.
It seemed quite natural to be discussing these grave affairs of state in such an irregular manner. And I felt no embarrassment at keeping up a monologue while Gandhi wrote his comments with the stub of a pencil on the backs of used envelopes. All the Mahatma's little scribbled messages were extremely friendly. At the same time, it was clear to me that he was in a state of considerable distress under the first impact of the plan.
At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom.
In agony that partition had taken such a horrific toll, Gandhi spent Independence Day in Calcutta, in prayer, fasting and spinning. He was weak, having survived his great fast that finally stopped the murder, plunder and fear that gripped that turbulent city. When New Delhi erupted, he went there and fasted again to stop the killings, constantly preaching tolerance and compassion towards Muslims. It was a message that enraged Hindu extremists. He stayed at Birla House. In the evenings, he held prayer meetings in his garden, attended by devoted crowds. And the last day of his life was as methodical as ever. Brij Krishna Chaliwala, who stayed with Gandhi, had it forever imprinted in his mind.
Well, that day, it was 30th of January, and Friday, and he began usually, as he used to get up at 3 o'clock, he began his day, had his prayers. Then the whole day he was very busy. 5 o'clock was the time for prayers, but the talks did not finish, so we were all very anxious. As he was very particular about having his prayers at the exact time.
At 5 past 5, the Mahatma, his arms on the shoulders of Abba and Manu, his female helpers, set out on the short walk from the house to a raised pavilion where he took prayers. Just then, a man, Nathuram Godse, stepped out of the congregation. He planted himself in front of Gandhi and fired 3 shots with a small revolver.
I couldn't understand what had happened because I had not thought that somebody would fire at him. So I moved and came in front of him. And I saw that blood was oozing out. Then I understood what had happened. For a few seconds, he was standing and at once he fell down and he was dead.
Friends and comrades, the light has gone out of our lives and there is darkness everywhere. And I do not quite know what to tell you and how to say it. Our beloved leader, Bapu as we called him, the father of the nation, is no more.
I do dimly perceive that whilst everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is underlying all that change a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates.
And you've been listening to a Radio Netherlands documentary by Piet Myers on the 50th assassination, 50th anniversary of the assassination of the great Indian leader Mahatma Gandhi, a man who has been remembered all over the world today. And today in New York at the United Nations, Mahatma Gandhi's grandson Arun Gandhi, together with Martin Luther King's son Martin Luther King III, will be launching a season of nonviolence from this day on the 50th anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi to the April 4th, 1998, the 30th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. We're now going to hear a speech of Martin Luther King in the 1960s as he came back from India and remembered Mahatma Gandhi.
Leaders in and out of government, organizations, particularly the Gandhi Smarak Nidhi and the Quaker Center, and many homes and families have done their utmost to make our short stay both pleasant and instructive. We have learned a lot. We are not rash enough to presume that we know India, vast subcontinent with all of its people, problems, contrasts and achievements. However, since we have been asked about our impressions, we venture one or two generalizations. First, we think that the spirit of Gandhi is much stronger today than some people believe. That is not only the direct and indirect influence of his comrades and associates, but also the organized efforts that are being made to preserve the Mahatma's letters and other writings, the pictures, monuments, the work of the Gandhi Smarak Nidhi and the movement led by the sainted Binova Bhave. These are but a few examples of the way Gandhiji will be permanently enshrined in the hearts of the people of India. Moreover, many governmental officials who do not follow Gandhi literally apply his spirit to domestic and international problems. Secondly, I wish to make a plea to the people and government of India. The issue of world peace is so critical that I feel compelled to offer a suggestion that came to me during the course of our conversations with Vinoba Bhave. The peace-loving peoples of the world have not yet succeeded in persuading my own country, America, and Soviet Russia to eliminate fear and disarm themselves. Unfortunately, as yet America and the Soviet Union have not shown the faith and moral courage to do this. Vinobaji has said that India or any other nation that has the faith and moral courage could disarm itself tomorrow, even unilaterally. It may be that just as India had to take the lead and show the world that national independence could be achieved nonviolently, so India may have to take the lead and call for universal disarmament. And if no other nation will join her immediately, India may declare itself for disarmament unilaterally. Such an act of courage would be a great demonstration of the spirit of the Mahatma and would be the greatest stimulus to the rest of the world to do likewise. Moreover, any nation that would take such a brave step would automatically draw to itself the support of the multitudes of the earth, so that any would-be aggressor would be discouraged from risking the wrath of mankind. May I also say that since being in India, I am more convinced than ever before that the method of non-violent resistance is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for justice and human dignity. In a real sense, Mahatma Gandhi embodied in his life certain universal principles that are inherent in the moral structure of the universe. These principles are as inescapable as the law of gravitation. Many years ago, when Abraham Lincoln was shot, and incidentally he was shot for the same reason that Mahatma Gandhi was shot for, namely for committing the crime of wanting to heal the wounds of a divided nation. And when he was shot, Secretary Stanton stood by the dead body of the great leader and said these words, "Now he belongs to the ages." And in a real sense, we can say the same thing about Mahatma Gandhi, and even in stronger terms, "Now he belongs to the ages." And if this age is to survive, it must follow the way of love and nonviolence that he so nobly illustrated in his life. And Mahatma Gandhi may well be God's appeal to this generation, a generation drifting again to its doom. And this eternal appeal is in the form of a warning: they that live by the sword shall perish by the sword. We must come to see in the world today that what he taught and his method throughout revealed to us that that is an alternative to violence, and that if we fail to follow this, we will perish in our individual and in our collective lives. For in a day when Sputniks and explorers dash through outer space and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere, no nation can win a war. Today, we no longer have a choice between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence.
And that was Martin Luther King, just after he returned from India as he remembered Mahatma Gandhi. We ask you to give us a call, and we'll give the number at the end of the show. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we go to the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, Arun Gandhi, who runs the M.K. Gandhi Center for Nonviolence in Memphis, Tennessee. He's at the United Nations today with Martin Luther King's son as they launch a season of nonviolence beginning today on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi and ending on April 4th, which is the 30th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. I spoke to him just a few minutes ago. On this 50th anniversary of your grandfather's assassination, can you tell us what your thoughts are?
Well, it brings back a lot of memories, good and bad, memories of my life with grandfather at the age of 12, just before he was assassinated. And, we were very concerned about how to commemorate this event because the 50th anniversary comes once in 50 years. So we decided that the best thing to do would be to link it with Dr. King's assassination, the 30th anniversary, and call it the season for nonviolence so that we can bring about better understanding between people and also create peace and harmony, the dream that both Gandhi and King shared.
Arun, can you say specifically, in your relationship with your grandfather, you were what, 12 years old when he was killed?
No, I was 14 when he was killed. I was 12. I went to him at the age of 12, and I lived with him for about 18 months between 12 and 14 years of age.
And what did he teach you about strategies of nonviolence? What did he teach you in general?
Well, he didn't actually teach me a lot about the strategies of nonviolence, but he taught me, for instance, I came from South Africa, and at the age of 10, I was beaten up by some white youths, and then a few months later, I was beaten up by black youths, both the times because they didn't like the color of my skin. And I had a lot of anger and rage in me, and I wanted eye for an eye justice. And my grandfather taught me that anger is something like electricity. It's just as powerful and just as useful only if we use it with respect and understanding, but it can be very deadly if we abuse it. So in the same way, we must learn to use anger in a positive way to resolve the issues that confront us rather than abuse anger and destroy ourselves and destroy everything. And he advised me to write an anger journal. He said, every time you feel anger coming up, pour it all out in your journal instead of pouring it on somebody or something. But write the journal with the intention and commitment to find a solution.
Were you with your grandfather when he was killed? Were you living with him?
No, I wasn't. We left India again in November 1947, just after independence. And so it was just a couple of months before his assassination.
So as a young man, as a 14-year-old, trying to absorb what had happened to him, that he'd been killed by the very violence he condemned, what did you make of it?
Well, my initial reaction was one of anger. I was so tremendously angered by the incident that I wanted to wring the neck of the person who had done it. But my father, who was the second son of Gandhi and the only one who really devoted his life to this philosophy, he and my mother both helped me overcome this and reminded me of the lessons that I learned from grandfather. And they said that he would not want us to take revenge. He would want us to forgive that person, and taught us how to do it.
Who did kill your grandfather? Who did kill Mahatma Gandhi?
Well, he was a fanatic Hindu who was misinformed. He didn't have all the facts right, and he felt that grandfather was being too lenient towards the Muslims. And the history behind it is that, grandfather really didn't want the country to be partitioned into India for Hindus and Pakistan for Muslims. He wanted one country, and he was prepared to wait for another 10 years, if necessary, to get one country. But the leaders of the Congress Party were by then getting too impatient, and they decided to bypass grandfather and go to the British and negotiate independence on the basis of partition. And the result of that was a tremendous upsurge of violence because millions of people were uprooted from one country and had to go to another country, leaving all their property and connections and everything behind. And that caused a lot of people to lose their lose economically as well as in other respects. So a lot of the fundamentalist Hindus then started this whole propaganda that the government of India should confiscate the cash assets that were due to Pakistan and use that money to compensate the Hindus who had lost their properties. And the government of India, playing populist politics, decided to agree on that, and they said they would not give Pakistan the cash that was due to them. And that's when grandfather went on a fast unto death, his last fast in New Delhi. And he said that if my country begins its new new independent life on an immoral act, then I don't want to be a part of that country. And so he forced the government to relent and give Pakistan the money that was due to them. And that was perceived by these fundamentalist Hindus as being lenient towards the Muslims. And so he felt that it was a conspiracy. It wasn't an individual alone who did it. But they felt that Gandhi needed to be eliminated. And so they conspired to kill him.
And what was the fallout of the killing of Gandhi?
Well, there was some violence that happened, but fortunately not too much of it, because people had already had a lot of violence between Hindus and Muslims, and when they realized that their own person had killed Gandhi, it sort of reacted in a way as to shock them into calmness, and people started looking inwards and taking stock of what they had done and what caused the tragedy there. And it was a tremendously shocking episode.
Did your grandfather know Martin Luther King?
No, they had never met each other. And I don't know if he... I don't think Dr. King was even in the news at that time for him to have heard of him. But grandfather had met a delegation of African-American people who had gone to India, and the delegation was led by Dr. Mordecai Johnson, and he was a very prominent African-American leader. And they had long discussions with grandfather about civil rights in this country and about nonviolence. And Mrs. Johnson invited grandfather to come to the U.S. and lead the civil rights movement. And grandfather promised her, saying that when I have finished my task here in India, and when India becomes independent, and if I am still alive after that, I will certainly come to the U.S. And teach people how to use nonviolence to win civil rights. And so that was the connection that he had with the African-American community here. I don't think he met Dr. King personally, or at least heard of him.
My last question, Arun Gandhi, is the picture that you have of your grandfather today.
I have the same picture of him that I had since I lived with him, a very warm-hearted, very loving, very compassionate person who believed in ideals. He believed in being very very committed to the cause that he had taken up, and was always willing to do whatever he had to do to achieve that goal that he had set for himself.
Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. He runs the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Memphis, Tennessee. We end with the words of Mahatma Gandhi, given in 1947 at the Inter-Asian Relations Conference in New Delhi, India.
At that time, I was the first in the field. Nevertheless, a coolie. You know perhaps what is meant by the word coolie. But this friend, his name was Kaur. His mother was a Frenchwoman. his father was an Englishman. And he said, I want to translate for you a French story. You will pardon me, those of you who know this story, if I make mistakes in recording it here and there, but there will be no mistake in the main incident. There were three scientists, and they, of course, it is an imaginary story, three scientists went out from France, went out of Europe in search of truth. That was the first lesson that story taught me, that if truth was to be searched, it was not to be found on the soil of Europe. Therefore, undoubtedly not in America. These three great scientists went to different parts of Asia. One of them found his way to India, and he began his search. He went to the so-called cities of those times. Naturally, this was before British occupation, before even the Mughal period. That is how the French author has illustrated the story. But still, he went through the cities. He saw the so-called high caste people, men and women. Till at last, he penetrated a humble cottage in a humble village, and that cottage was a Bhangi cottage. And he found the truth that he was in search of in that Bhangi cottage, in the Bhangi family, man, woman, perhaps two or three children. I speak there under correction. And then he describes how he found it. I omit all that thing. I want to connect that story with what I want to say to you, that if you really want to see India at its best, you have to find it in a Bhangi cottage, in a humble Bhangi home. Of such villages, so the English historians teach us, are 700,000. A few cities here and there, they don't hold several crores of people, but the 700,000 villages do hold nearly 40 crores of people. I say nearly because you may take away 1 crore perhaps. Maybe 2 crores in the cities, still there will be 38 crores. And then I said to myself, if these friends go away without finding their true India, what will they have found? I then thought that I would beseech you to imagine this India, not from this vast audience, but to imagine what it would be like. Then I would like you to read a story such as this brilliant story of Frenchmen.
Mahatma Gandhi in 1947 in New Delhi, India, addressing the Inter-Asian Relations Conference. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, which is produced by He Soo Koo, our engineer, Errol Maitland, executive producer, Julie Drizin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another...